Blog Talk Radio.
Dallas, Texas, on Monday, February the 4th, day number 35 of 2013. And tonight we're going to do a little military history. I'm sure many of you are big fans of military history. I am, and we have one of the best guests tonight when it comes to military history, and that's Barry Jacobson, who's going to be joining us tonight to talk about one of the most important military moments of the 20th century, at least, let's say, after World War II. And that was the Vietnam War, and in particular, the Tet Offensive, which is something that was happening 45 years ago today, as we speak, 45 years ago. We're going to talk a little bit about what it did, or what happened in the Tet Offensive, how it impacted the war, but more importantly, how it impacted the country politically, because the Tet Offensive in many ways, changed public attitudes about Vietnam. We're going to get into that tonight with Barry Jacobson, and Leslie Eastman is also going to be joining us tonight as well. She's got some new information about the king's name, but she's got some new information on that she's going to share with us tonight. So when she comes on, I'll let her explain that to you. First of all, I want to thank the management of Blog Talk Radio for featuring our program today. It's always a good thing when they feature the program. It means that we're going to be frankly, reaching a lot more people, introducing our program to a lot more people. And we've been doing a lot of these military history shows with Barry, and they've turned out to be very popular shows. And I think the one tonight is also going to be extremely good. So let's get started. Let's get going with our program, and we're going to take a little break. We're going to hear from our sponsor, Avalon Professional Translation, and then we'll be back with Barry Jacobson and the Vietnam War.
Sending the right message in multiple languages is easy with Avalon Professional Translation Services. Avalon provides document and web translation in 62 languages. In addition, access to 140 languages is just a phone call away any day of the year. Events, even court depositions, no problem for Avalon. Call 972-404-1213 or go to avalontranslation.com. Avalon Professional Translation Services, global communications made easy.
That's exactly right, and we have a link to the Avalon Professional Translation website. If you look in the show information under the guest, you will see our sponsor's name, and of course, Avalon Professional Translation here in Dallas, Texas. The owner of Avalon, Leonard Shokoff, is a good friend. I've known him for 20 years. They do a great job, I mean, a really good job at Avalon, translating documents, whether it's a private document or a marketing document for your business, a technical document, whatever it may be. They do a great job at Avalon. So give them a call, and as I say, all you got to do is click that little information on the show information right there. Click on that, and that'll take you to the Avalon Professional website, where you can call them and tell them that you heard about it on the radio, and tell Leonard that you want him back on the radio. Leonard has been traveling so much, we never get to have him back on the radio. One of these days, we're going to get him back on the radio. I always enjoy it when he joins us on the air. But he's been traveling, he's been out of town, and unfortunately just cannot join us. So I'm hoping that one of these days I can say hello to Leonard on the air, just like I'm saying hello to Leslie Eastman. How are you, Leslie?
Good evening, Silvio. How are you tonight?
Absolutely great. Absolutely great. You know, I was trying to tell the audience, and I made a boo-boo. I was trying to explain to the audience that what you're going to talk about later in the show tonight regarding Richard, is it Richard III?
Richard III, yes. It's actually a very intriguing and interesting historical discovery that they've made, and I thought it'd be very, of interest to your audience who seems to enjoy our history shows so very much.
Absolutely. So you're going to hold that, and you're going to tell us that and you know, after we do our conversation with Barry Jacobson about the Vietnam War and the Tet Offensive, a couple of things here, Leslie, that I thought were interesting. By the way, breaking story, just as we're going in the air right now, apparently that standoff in Alabama has ended. And as I understand, Leslie, maybe you know more, but as I understand, the little boy was saved, or he was rescued, and the man who was holding him was apparently killed by the police. That's what I know. Is that about what you know?
That's about all I know. I must admit, I've been in a business meeting all day, so I haven't really kept up with the news, but that corresponds to what I've been able to glean from the few Facebook posts I've seen on the subject.
Yeah, I just, as I said, I just saw the TV right before we went on, and that's what they were saying. So we're happy for the little boy who I'm sure was put through quite an ordeal during this terrible, whatever it was, 4 or 5 days where he was being held hostage. Just a couple of things from on this day in history while we wait for Barry to check in. 1789, Leslie, today, 1789, President Washington was formally elected president through the Electoral College. He had won the election in November, but it was on this day in 1789 that they counted all the votes, and he was formally elected president. So we remember that on this day in history. 1945, a very important thing, the Yalta Conference, where you had Stalin and FDR and Churchill getting together, and they were basically carving out Europe, you know, what Europe would look like after the war. Of course, less than 2 months later, it wasn't FDR anymore, but it was Truman who was, you know, serving as American president during those sessions. Very interesting part of history because, obviously, people like the people in Poland, and we had a show about Poland not too long ago, they felt a little cheated because, you know, they went into the war under the Nazis and they came out of the war under the communists. So they didn't exactly get a good break out of what happened in the Yalta Conference. And then, of course, the last thing on this day in history, and this is really fitting given our topic tonight, on this day in history, Leslie, 1962, the first American helicopter was shot down in Vietnam. So a good day to talk about the Vietnam War on the day that something like this happened. But I was telling the audience, as we wait for Barry, I was telling the audience that before you came on that these military history shows that we've been doing, we're very fortunate to have Barry because he is such a knowledgeable guy when it comes to military history. And that's a real specialty, Leslie, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is, and it is kind of fascinating how he and I met. I have always long been a history fan, and at the fencing school where my son was is learning fencing, they were holding a special summer camp featuring the deadliest warrior, you know, pitting two historical warriors against each other, and it was based on the series he was an associate producer of. So I would watch these videos in total fascination, but I was focused on the laboratory aspects of it because I liked, you know, the tests they ran on the weapons and the damage it was inflicted. So I really didn't pay attention to the reenactments. And I really didn't pay attention to him when he was on because he was discussing non-lab things. So when I met him to discuss the show, I think I went on for about 5 minutes on all the laboratory stuff. But in the conversation, it really became apparent how much he enjoyed the military history aspect. He got me to realize that I needed to come out of the lab a little bit. And as a result, as we've become friends and I've taught him to blog, he's taught me so very much about, you know, important aspects of history I had since neglected. So I was really glad he's been able to join us as often as he is to share his immense knowledge with your audience.
That's right, and it is really very cool, Leslie, because we all like history, but military history is a real specialty within history. And speaking of the specialists, we've got Barry on. How are you, Barry? Welcome.
Good evening, Silvio, and good evening, Leslie.
Good
well,
evening.
How is everything in the West Coast these days? Guys, you got to fill me in on the weather in the West Coast.
Well, it's usually boring. The easiest job in the world is being a weatherman out here. Generally, it's sunny most of the time, light clouds, if any. Although we have had some rain in the last 2 weeks off and on. But compared to Seattle or any other part of the country, they don't call this rain. This would be just a light mist and a heavy dew.
So what do you say, Leslie? Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah, it's really, you know, as my friend used to say, it's another hellish day in paradise, you know. So there is a reason I moved to here from Detroit, Michigan. And if we're going to be paying high taxes, at least we can enjoy some of the perks.
Right. At least the weather's nice. You know, you don't have snowstorms. But I mean, yeah, here in Texas today, we're actually a little humid, actually. It's a little humid and very nice. Well, Barry, we're going to talk tonight about the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. But I thought, you know, I would just bring this up. I think I sent you an email about this, that this was the day we celebrate today, the anniversary of the first helicopter being shot down in Vietnam. And that, of course, was 1962. So we kind of begin our chat today by looking a little bit at the history of the Vietnam War. And as I understand it, Barry, going back to the Vietnam War, but before I do that, I forgot the obvious. Forgive me. Please tell us about yourself, Barry. I'm sorry. I should have asked you that, and I didn't. So please tell us about yourself.
No problem at all. Well, I'm an ex-Green Beret, if there is such a thing. I was in Army Special Forces for 8 years. Served on about three different continents, specializing in scuba operations, mostly in helicopter rappel and parachuting and what have you. My medical field was my background as a medical specialist with light weapons as my cross training. When I got out of the military, I got into hyperbaric medicine, started my own business, eventually became a business owner. But germane to this evening's discussion, I'm an amateur historian. I blog at Deadliest Blogger. That's my military history blog. And I blog politically at Word Warrior of SoCal. I've also been, for the last 37 years, a medieval and ancient combat expert, reenactor, fighting with medieval and ancient weapons in medieval or ancient armor. And for two seasons, I was the associate producer and military advisor to the TV show Deadliest Warrior on Spike TV.
Great.
But
that's
kind of all of that in a nutshell.
Yes, well, that's good to know. I wanted to make sure the audience had that background, because Leslie and I were talking about you as a military historian, but I think it's important for them to know the entire story of Barry Jacobson. Now, let's begin with the Vietnam War, because I found this interesting that, you know, I remember reading this article one time by Bill Kristol, the fellow with the Weekly Standard, who's often on Fox News Sunday, and he was talking about how in 1960, when we were having a presidential election, that time between Kennedy and Nixon, Vietnam never came up. There was not a single debate or a single word about Vietnam, the issue that would become the biggest issue, at least foreign policy issue, of the 1960s. So when did Vietnam become an issue for the United States? I know that we had troops in Vietnam even when John Kennedy was assassinated. We had like 20,000 support troops, or I guess not support troops, people training, I guess. But when did Vietnam really become the issue that eventually became?
Well, let me back up just a little bit. Vietnam really began in 1946, though the American involvement directly didn't begin to, you know, quite a bit later. It began with the French. Vietnam, then known as Indochina, was a French colony, part of the French Empire. And in 1946 to about 1955, the French were fighting a communist insurgency called the Viet Minh, and led by a man by the name of Ho Chi Minh. And the French didn't have all the resources we had. We gave them some help, but not a whole lot. And eventually in 1954, the French, despite having some very good quality troops, particularly the French-born Legion, units that were mostly made up, or much of them were made up of German troops that had been part of the Wehrmacht and the SS during World War II, and then later joined the French-born Legion after the war. So despite having good troops, they didn't have the resources that we had, and they were defeated at a place called Dien. And that was 1954. So the United States, which was fighting the Cold War against Stalinism and Mao in China, and was involved from 1950 until 54 in our own war in Korea against the communists, began sending military advisors to help these South Vietnamese who were pro-Western against the communist brothers in the North. Vietnam had been divided after the French left into North and South Vietnam. And South Vietnam received American support until and through 1965 in the form of mostly special forces, Green Beret advisors, and other kinds of American specialists who operated with the South Vietnamese Army, trying to make it a first-class or even a second-class fighting force. This army was called the ARVN, A-R-V-N, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. And they're fighting mostly against a local insurgency, South Vietnamese communist insurgency, known as the Viet Cong, that was heavily backed by the North Vietnamese, and in some cases, North Vietnamese regular troops fought with them. Those were called the PAVN, the People's Army of Vietnam, though we refer to them mostly as NVA, North Vietnamese Army. So from up until 1965, we were supporting South Vietnam as part of the Cold War, one of the many savage wars of peace, as Max Boot calls it in his book. And these kind of brushfire wars went on all throughout the Third World during the Cold War between our proxies and Soviet proxies. They tried to overthrow our proxies. We tried to overthrow theirs. The Bay of Pigs, for instance, which we talked about last month, was just one of those incidents in the Cold War. So Vietnam got much, much bigger, though, in 1965 when President Johnson, seeing that the war was being lost slowly but surely, decided to commit major American ground forces. And the Marines landed in force at Da Nang along the coast. And within 2 years, 3 years, there was about 500,000 American troops that had been committed all along the country of South Vietnam.
Let me ask you a question as we go along, because I've got a couple of questions I want to ask you as we go through the story. I've read, and I don't know if maybe you've read the same thing, that number one, President Eisenhower, at the time, former President Eisenhower, was really opposed to a land war in Asia, that he wanted nothing to do with it. Said he had advised both President Kennedy and President Johnson not to do it. And even MacArthur, as he was dying, apparently President Johnson went to see him at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington when he was dying. And he warned President Johnson about a land war in Asia. Are you familiar with those two things?
I wasn't familiar with MacArthur, Sylvia. I was familiar with Eisenhower advising against it.
Okay. I was just, I've read these things, and, you know, sometimes things end up in books that may or may not be true. But I think in the case of MacArthur is because he had known, or he had the experience, I suppose, of Korea, right?
Yes, though MacArthur was all for a land war in Asia in those days, back in the early 50s. His greatest, fondest desire in 1950, or actually from late 40s until he was relieved in 1950 by Truman in December of 1950, his fondest hope was that Mao and the communists would invade the island of Taiwan, and that would give them the golden opportunity of basically sinking them on the high sea, inflicting a massive defeat, and then followed up with an invasion of the mainland to reinstall Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists in China.
Interesting.
But I'm not at all surprised that his feelings may have changed over the intervening years between that, you know, that and Vietnam.
Of course, and we don't know the full context of the conversation. They may have been talking about it, but maybe in a different context or whatever. But I think there was great concern, though, after Korea, there was great concern about public opinion and involving the country in another difficult war. Maybe that's what MacArthur was talking about, but who knows. But before we get to 65, though, maybe you got to mention this in your presentation. Before we get to 65, we have an election here in 64, and we have something called the Gulf of Tonkin incident where, you know, a resolution is passed by the Congress, and that resolution basically becomes the declaration of war against Vietnam.
Well, yeah, on August 2nd, 1964, a U.S. Navy destroyer, the Maddox, was attacked by North Vietnamese gunboats, essentially not much more than PT boats like we used in World War II. And that was used as, that so-called Gulf of Tonkin incident was used as an excuse, or perhaps a good reason, depending on whether you believe it or not. There's skepticism as to whether the attack actually happened as was reported. But it was considered to be an act of communist aggression against the American Navy, which was operating outside of their territorial waters and on the the high seas. So that led to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in Congress, which gave President Johnson the authority that he needed for Congress to assist South Vietnam in curbing communist aggression. And, you and I are old enough to remember this, but for the young audience who may not remember anything about the Cold War, what always overshadowed the Cold War was the fact that the Cold War could become a hot war between us and the Soviets, and later on the Red Chinese, and in fact become a thermonuclear war. So Johnson, who was running against Barry Goldwater, the Republican candidate, Barry Goldwater was a senator from Arizona and very conservative. In fact, he's probably the father of the modern conservative movement, right along with Ronald Reagan and William F. Buckley. But Barry Goldwater was running, and Johnson painted him as a hawk who, he got into the White House, would greatly expand the war in Vietnam and, in fact, cause us to go to, state of nuclear war, perhaps against the Soviets or the Chinese.
Now,
and he played on those fears.
Yeah, let me just back up for a second, because what changed, other than maybe just politics, what changed with President Johnson? Because, I mean, you're exactly right. During the campaign, he said he wasn't going to get us involved, and then all of a sudden, the escalation is, like, incredible. You know, we go from having basically advisors to having a half a million troops, I think, by 67 we had a half a million troops. So what changed in your research? What changed? Was President Johnson given information and told that basically, South Vietnam couldn't do it without U.S. troops and we have to go in there? Did that happen?
Well, there have been problems with the South Vietnamese as a proxy for some time. If you remember, there was a president by the name of Diem during Kennedy's administration that had to be or seemed to be losing the war. And so he was overthrown by his generals with what many historians think is the connivance of and the conspiracy with the CIA to put stronger men in there that can win the war. And the strong men were Key, Nguyen Cao Key, and they're both military generals. And but they were not delivering the goods. The war was being lost. And Johnson did not want to be the first president to lose, a war against the communists. In fact, go down in history as a man who lost Vietnam. And though I'm not an expert on Johnson, there's lots of really good books on the subject that I would advise readers to look into, but that's not my particular area of expertise. But in any case, Johnson, after the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and after the 64 election, did exactly what he was accusing or suggesting that Barry Goldwater would have done, which is to expand the war in Vietnam.
Right.
Ironically.
That's right. And just to be fair to Barry Goldwater, because I've read his memoirs and I'm a big fan of Barry Goldwater, what Barry Goldwater was not talking about a land war in Southeast Asia. What he was talking about was basically using bombing certain key places in North Vietnam and basically demonstrating to the North that we were serious and we would, but he wasn't, necessarily supporting sending a half a million men. In fact, he was never really in favor of that. He always had some real reservations about the Vietnam War. So that takes us now, Barry, to about 66, 67. Now you're beginning to see a lot of anti-war demonstrations back here. Of course, we need to remind the audience that the soldiers who were fighting in Vietnam were drafted soldiers. They were not volunteers like we have now. So that obviously had some political consequences. 1967 is a very tough year for the war. Now we're coming at the end of 67 into 68, and the Tet Offensive happens. Did I miss anything, or did you want into the...
Let me paint the picture of what was going on, because this Tet Offensive was very well planned. The planning began in May of the year previous, 1967. One of the things you got to keep in mind about the Tet Offensive is why it ended quite differently than either side expected. was that both sides had very unrealistic expectations of what was happening, or an unrealistic picture of what was happening, what could happen. The North Vietnamese themselves had a war going on between two factions in their Politburo. One faction was for a long, protracted guerrilla war, and slowly to win through attrition and the war of words, and at the same time negotiate and basically wear out America with promises of, you know, peace, and at the same time wearing down our troops. And in fact, that's the strategy that was eventually, after Tet, implemented, the slow attrition strategy. The other faction, the militant faction, which had been really in charge since 1965, and was led by by a guy named Tran, who was the leader of the forces fighting in South Vietnam. He was opposed to General Giap, who was the leader of the previous faction, and his faction, the militant faction, wanted to provoke a general uprising. And the expectation, which proved to be false, was that the South Vietnamese government was wildly unpopular, and that the continuing colonial struggle, as they saw it, which began with the French and was in their minds still going on to liberate their country, this part of the south of their country, from the new colonial power being America, that the people would rise up and would greet their liberators. And what the strategy was going to be, and this is what led to the Tet Offensive, was to launch attacks across the entire country, aimed at mostly political and military headquarters. And in doing so, to execute large numbers of the leadership cadre in South Vietnam, both political and civilian and military. But the people then rise up and support the liberators, the PAVN and the Viet Cong troops. And to prepare for this, there was nonstop convoys of munitions being marched down the Ho Chi Minh Trail from the north. There was about a 15-fold increase from 1967 to December of 67, from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. And, in fact, Westmoreland knew about that, General Westmoreland being the commander of American forces in Vietnam. And he was warning that there would be an attack, which he, in fact, welcomed, which we'll get to in just a minute. But it was unrealistic that the people of South Vietnam would rise up to fight the communists. They had never really supported the communists in really large numbers, even though there was about 400,000 Viet Cong in South Vietnam, a very large force. A lot of those were merely sympathizers, not fighting troops. So that was the North Vietnamese expectations. And then the American expectation was also faulty. We expected that the enemy were incapable of launching a nationwide or a countrywide offensive. Our intelligence, provided by both the CIA and by military intelligence, both American Army and the South Vietnamese Army, led us to believe their capabilities were much more limited than they really were. So in January, and that leads us to the offensive, in January of 1968, about the 20th or so, I'd have to go back and look, but about 15 days before the Tet Offensive, General Giap, who has now been given command of the overall operation, he's the same man who won the Battle of Dien Bien Phu back in 54 against the French, he launches an attack on Khe Sanh in the north. And Khe Sanh is a Marine Corps base with an airfield, and it's in a valley surrounded by mountains. And in many ways, it resembles Dien Bien Phu. And Giap thinks he can inflict the same sort of crushing defeat by occupying the hills around with artillery positions to overlook the airfield and besieging the Marine Corps garrison like he did the French, and eventually causing them to surrender and inflicting a major military defeat. This, of course, is just a prelude and a distraction, as well as, I mean, he's hoping for victory, but it's really a distraction preparing for the Tet that's coming up. And to further distract the Americans and to have them drop their guard, politically there's been a truce that's been agreed to by both sides that there will be a ceasefire during the Tet, which is a lunar holiday. And so both sides were agreed to this, and the communists, of course, broke this truce. So when the Tet Offensive does break out on January 30th at midnight, Westmoreland, for the next 15 days, continues to think it's merely a diversion from the real battle he thinks is occurring at the Khe Sanh. and he kind of makes a fool of himself by declaring this, you know, this is just a diversion. Don't worry about it, folks. It's just a diversion. So on January 30th, the offensive begins, and it begins with in the north, in Hue, Pleiku, Da Nang, I Trang, and other places in the north, where Viet Cong sappers and backed up by main force battalions attack all across the north, and in Hue they overrun the city very quickly, Hue being the old imperial capital of Vietnam. And in their wake, wherever they go in the occupied territory, there's massacres that are committed and atrocities. Some 6,000 people, civilians, are massacred in Hue alone. The following day, the 31st of January, they overrun targets all throughout South Vietnam, including Saigon, where they even succeed in breaking into the grounds of the American embassy.
That's right.
And platoon strength.
Why don't we break at this moment, Barry? We're going to take a little break. We can hear from our sponsor, and then we haven't forgotten about Leslie. She's there listening to us, aren't you, Leslie?
Definitely. I'm very fascinated.
All right. Anyways, we're going to take a little break, Barry. When we come back, we'll pick up the actual offensive itself, what happens, and how it impacts the United States and South Vietnam and everybody militarily and, of course, the United States politically. We're going to hear from our friend Aaron Clary, and then we'll be back with more of our conversation with Barry Jacobson.
Parents, when you talk about your children, do you say, I can't wait for little Jimmy to grow up to become a stock boy, or I can't wait for precious little Susie to grow up to become a stripper? No, of course you don't. You love your children. The problem is you're unconsciously sending them down that path unless you have a heart-to-heart talk with them about what to major in college. Hi, everybody. My name's Aaron Clary, author of the book Worthless. Look, you or your children are going to blow $50,000 to $100,000 in tuition getting this degree. Not to mention your children are going to spend 4 to 8 years of their youth earning that degree, and we're still, if they make the wrong decision, they'll not only be in debt, but they won't have a commensurate increase in their earnings potential, making them financially crippled for the rest of their life. This investment has to pay off, so ensure they choose the right major. Buy my book, Worthless. In my book, Worthless, I explain in clear language why some degrees are worthwhile and while others are literally worthless. We go over starting salaries, unemployment rates, but more importantly, the economics of why some degrees are better than others, explaining to the kids, not merely saying, major in this, don't major in that. You can find Worthless on Amazon.com. It's $13 in paperback, $5 on Kindle. I promise you it will be a better investment than college itself. That's Worthless. You can get it on Amazon.com.
I'm having so many problems tonight. I'm going to have to switch to this.
Barry, are you with me?
I'm with you.
Okay, we were having some problems there. I don't know what happened, but anyway, I think we may have lost some of the broadcast. But anyway, I was just saying that we were in the beginning of a political season, and and then that's when the Tet Offensive happens, and we were just talking about about the fact that they had broken into the American embassy in Saigon. So why don't we pick it up there?
Okay. Yes, they broke into a lot of targets. They overran the grounds of the American embassy, where they were, but then held off by a handful of Marines for actually entering the main building. And they went around in Saigon, among other things, rounding up families of the national police and military officials and executing them. They had death squads with blacklists. They're going to talk about the Viet Cong now. And one of the iconic moments of the Tet Offensive is a photograph that's taken by a photographer named Eddie Adams. And Eddie Adams's picture shows the general in command of the national police executing with a pistol on the streets in broad daylight a Viet Cong member in plain clothes shooting him in the head, which, of course, becomes a big Associated Press story and is used as an iconic example of how our allies, the South Vietnamese, are no better than the communists. But the backstory of that picture, which Eddie Adams himself later admitted to and regretted that it became such a big deal, was that the general who actually pulled the trigger, General Nguyen Ngoc Leon, Major General of the National Police Force, had been rounding up Viet Cong who were executing family members of his own police force. And in fact, he had found an open trench full of dead bodies, which included several of his godchildren. And he found this man who was the commander of the force doing the killing, and he took him out summarily and shot him. And that's the human side of that incident. It was never really portrayed by the mainstream press. It was sort of swept under the carpet. We only saw the picture and was left to believe that this was an unprovoked act of
plain
murder.
And that picture went all over the world. That almost became the anti-American picture of the late 60s, you know. It was a picture, it was a terrible situation. You put a gun to this guy's head, and it became kind of, you know, the darling of all of the anti-Americans, that picture, you know, if you know what I mean.
And funny enough, later on, when this general moved to America after the war, he settled in Virginia, he and Eddie Burke got to know each other. Eddie Adams got to know each other. And Eddie Adams said it was one of the sorriest things that he ever did was to take that picture, because it brought disgrace upon this general who didn't deserve it.
That's right. That's exactly right. Well, I think what is now happening, and by the way, let me apologize to the audience. It does look like we lost about a minute of airtime on the show. I don't know what happened. There was a technical glitch, so it's possible that about a minute there between the commercial and my conversation with Barry, that we may have lost a little bit, about a minute of the show, as I can tell. But anyway, not the whole show, but just about a minute there, as I was explaining about the presidential elections in the United States. So now, all of a sudden, back home, the American people are watching these scenes from Vietnam, and they don't look really good, Barry. I mean, not just the shooting of that from that general, but just the overall sense that something is going wrong here in Vietnam.
Well, part of the problem was a PR one, and one of unmet expectations. General Westmoreland, who commanded the American forces in Vietnam, and really everybody from McNamara on down, Robert McNamara being the Secretary of Defense, had been saying the war was being won. All throughout 1967, the Johnson administration was on a PR campaign with people from Hubert Humphrey, the Vice President, to Westmoreland, saying that, you know, peace is at hand, we're beginning to win the struggle. At the National Press Club in November of 67, Westmoreland had said that the communists were, in fact, unable to mount a major offensive. And, in fact, that in 65, where they'd been winning, that today they were certainly losing. So when 2 months later, all across the entire country, a massive offensive breaks out, Westmoreland looks like he's been, and the Johnson administration looks like they've been lying to the American people the whole time.
Right.
Or at the very least, that the war is not close to being finished, not close to being done. And when the Americans, and sadly for America, and it's really a phenomenon that's lasted, or has begun since World War II, but we've become very impatient as a people. when it comes to war. You know, wars are not won overnight. The average war we fought is about 4 years long. But if you look back even as far as the Civil War, by 1864, America was pretty exhausted, war-weary, ready for that war to end.
Yeah.
And Vietnam was no different. So the war, which lasted nearly 10 years, just wore America out. But getting back to the Tet Offensive, so the offensive breaks out, and though within 24 hours, the Viet Cong are everywhere getting beaten back. It's important to remember that guerrilla forces are generally light infantry at best, and usually badly undertrained light infantry, meaning they have nothing but sidearms or light weapons. They generally don't have a lot of heavy weapons. Mortars or whatever they can get in the way of artillery. So the Viet Cong were really good at guerrilla operations. Particularly those conducted against innocent civilian populations that weren't undefended. Typically, the Viet Cong would go into villages at nighttime and terrorize the villages, supporting them. But when they came out of the shadows and attacked both the ARVN and the United States Army in the Tet Offensive, they exposed themselves. And for the next 6 weeks, they were pounded badly. The People's Army of Vietnam was decimated. That's the North Vietnamese contingent. But the Viet Cong was nearly wiped out. From the Tet Offensive, after the Tet Offensive, the Viet Cong ceased to be a serious military threat. In fact, their cadres had to be filled with recruits from the North. They were no longer able to recruit from the South because they'd just been decimated. So militarily speaking, the Tet Offensive was a victory for Westmoreland. We did very little to earn that victory. But, you know, the fighting in Hue was bloody, but we lost 200 Americans. We inflicted, you know, 4,000, 6,000 casualties on the Viet Cong. So it was a very one-sided victory for America, all throughout the Tet Offensive, whether it was in Saigon or Hue, even Khe Sanh. We bloodied them very badly. And that's exactly what you want in a guerrilla war. You want an opportunity to get the guerrillas out of the shadows, out of the jungles, get them concentrated in one place and smash them. And that's what the Tet Offensive allowed us to do. Interesting enough, and this is the irony of the whole thing, is because of the expectation game, because it seemed that suddenly everything that the American people had been told had been proven false, and that there was still a lot of fight left in the communists, and the war didn't seem to be ending anytime soon. The communists and their allies in the left-wing press throughout the world were able to turn what was a military disaster into a political victory.
That's right.
Propaganda victory.
That's exactly right. No, you're exactly right on that, and that's the tragedy of it, that what should have been an American victory became an American defeat, and politically back here, it was horrible for President Johnson. In fact, he eventually withdrew. The convention in Chicago turned into a big anti-war disaster for the Democrats. But it was politically a disaster for President Johnson, who, as I said, chose not to run for re-election. But I think if I could, you know, as we're coming here to the end, Barry, if I could sort of wrap it up this way, there was a great book that President Nixon wrote after he left office called No More Vietnams. Did you have a chance to see that? Or read that book?
Not. Yeah. I didn't get a chance, no.
And this is a great book, I think, that I think everyone, whoever runs for president, should read it, because he basically made the point in that book. I mean, he went through all of the different key moments in the Vietnam War and how we basically allowed public opinion and military victories turn into military defeats. So a very interesting book. But I think the lesson, if we could wrap it up tonight, Barry, the lesson of Vietnam is that if you're going to get into a war, you better fight to win. Would you agree with that?
I would. And I would also point out that the wars are lost at their highest level. They're won or lost at the highest level. They're not won or lost tactically on the field by squads. And they're not won even by big divisions in battle. So that contributes to victory. They're won on the strategic level back home, and that victory begins or defeat begins with the morale of the people.
Right.
If the people don't support the war, and there's no grand strategy to win the war at the highest level in our country, that being the president and his national security staff, and the Pentagon, and, you know, at the highest level, the Secretary of Defense. If there is no strategy to win the war, then we will not win the war. Right. There was no strategy to win the Vietnam War. It really became a war of containment, trying to contain the communist aggression.
Right.
And I think that's where it began to go wrong from the very beginning.
Right. And then all you needed was something like Tet to turn everything upside down. But I also felt, and looking back, because I've read a great deal of about that period, and I've read a great deal of what was going on in the Johnson administration. I don't think President Johnson ever really explained to the American people properly why we were there. And I think that they were hoping that maybe we could just send troops and eventually bring them home. But it got out of their hand. It just got out of control, I think.
Another thing I'd add to that, Sylvia, was the way we fought the war was completely asinine. For the Viet Cong and the NVA, it was one war that lasted 10 years. But for the American soldiers, it was 10 wars lasting a year each. We would send new recruits over there every year, replacing the draftees that were going home. So, and troops are constantly being rotated in every year, new troops, green troops, fresh troops with no experience, while the enemy were continuing to gain experience every year and getting tougher and harder and more savvy. So just about the time at the end of their first year in Vietnam that our American soldiers had learned the tricks and learned how to survive, learned how to fight in that very harsh jungle environment, they'd be sent home.
They'd go
home and be replaced by a green recruit that came just out of boot camp.
Right.
And
no, you're exactly right.
Stupid way to fight
right.
a war.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right about that. And it's just a shame. We lost 60,000 young men in that war, and I happened to know one of those young men who was killed. Was the older brother of a friend of mine in high school, and I didn't know him real well, but I met him a couple of times. And I think that Vietnam War really touched just about every neighborhood in the country, and it was really a brutal war. But, Barry, I want to thank you so much for this excellent presentation on the Tet Offensive and the Vietnam War. And if you want to hang with us for a few minutes here, because Leslie has a little historical contribution that she wants to make about another time and place, Leslie.
Yeah, and this is great because apparently Barry is also an expert in this as well. About 5 months ago, underneath the parking lot that was once the spot where an abbey was, they uncovered some bones, and mitochondrial DNA analysis has shown that they are probably those of Richard III, the last Plantagenet king of England, who died in Battle of Bosworth and basically handed the throne at that point over to Henry Tudor, Henry VII, and, of course, his house that had Henry VIII and, of course, Elizabeth I. So a very interesting character depicted as a tyrant. And, Barry, why don't you pick it up from here on more on Richard III?
Well, Richard III is a much maligned character. Shakespeare made him famous in his play, Richard III, as a hunchback with a crooked, twisted, withered arm. Who steals the throne once his brother, King Edward IV, dies from his two nephews, Edward V, who's adolescent, and his younger brother, Richard, that he has these two young princes locked up in the Tower of London and eventually quietly murdered in order to seize the throne. And, you know, there is a group called the Richard III Society, very, very strong in England, that has been trying to repair his reputation. And have lots of reasons why this probably is not a true story, that it's, in fact, propaganda by the Tudors, of whom Shakespeare was being patronized by. You know, Queen Elizabeth was his patron. And Henry Tudor, who was Richard's enemy at Bosworth Field, the battle where he died, was Elizabeth's grandfather. So, Richard was the last of the Plantagenets. He died and was buried in the Battle of Bosworth, hacked down. And now we have found on the site, which must have been the site of Greyfriar Abbey, where he was buried, but the abbey was later destroyed by Henry VIII and further destroyed during the English Civil War of the 17th century. We found the skeleton, and using DNA, which there's not too many surviving members of his family, but they found one in Canada, apparently.
Wow.
Yeah, from the mitochondrial DNA, you need a descendant from the matrilineal line, and they found a direct descendant of Richard III's sister, Anne of York. And using that, they've got that that it looks like it is. It's not 100% a perfect match like regular DNA is, but given the wounds and given the location and the general structure of the skeleton, it tends to line up with the fact that it's Richard III.
Well, I would have never thought we'd be talking about Ho Chi Minh and Richard III on the same show, but we did tonight.
Well, if I may add one last piece, what I found really interesting about this is that while there is no evidence of a withered arm, the skeleton apparently has scoliosis so bad that his normal stature would have been about 5'8", which is fairly average for a man of that time. But he would have probably appeared much shorter because of his scoliosis, leading to the idea of him being a crookback, not a hunchback, but a crookback. And so there's some truth to that. His wounds were head wounds inflicted probably by a halberd, in which one pierced his skull, apparently cut clear through the skull and hit the back side of the skull, went to one side and hit the other side. So almost nearly instantly fatal.
Maybe a stupid question, but why would he be in the battle? Why would the king be actually in battle?
Well, you know, the idea of kings and heads of state not fighting in battles is a fairly recent concept.
Oh, okay.
Throughout human history, kings did fight. The last one in England to fight in battle was James II, who fought at the Battle of the Boyne in Ireland in the 17th century. But Richard led the final charge at Bosworth Field, leading his bodyguard to try to hack down his enemy.
Wow.
And it was only treachery at the last minute by a traitor within his own ranks, Lord Stanley, that stopped him from killing Henry Tudor with his own battle axe.
So the idea of leaders going out to battle, I guess, is a more recent thing. I didn't know that. So, I mean, you go back 500, 600 years, and the king was in the battle, I guess.
Not always, but usually. And at the very least, the king was a warrior. You'd be expected to be able to fight in the battle if you didn't.
Yeah. So he was at least trained in military. It's not like today where we have so many civilian presidents, although we've had a lot of presidents who have served in the military in one capacity or another. Well, Barry, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's always a real treat. I know it's a complicated topic. We wanted to get as much in as possible, but I want to thank you again for just giving us your expertise. You're an absolutely wonderful guy. I mean, your knowledge of history is unbelievable. You must have done a lot of study.
Well, it is my passion. You know, I read incessantly and have been since I was about 12 years old. And even though sometimes I can't remember my own Social Security number, I can, for some weird reason, I just never forget what I read when it comes to history. Don't ask me why.
You don't remember your Social Security number, but you know who Richard III was dating when he was 18, right?
Precisely. Her name was Matilda.
That's right.
Matilda
okay. Bjork. Very good. Excellent. Well, Leslie, why don't you fill us in? You have a guest on Thursday that you're bringing us.
Yes, it's Katja, who is writes at the blog at the Edge of the Sandbox, Biting My Tongue. She's a Soviet immigrant. She's Jewish. She's independent, conservative, and she's very opinionated. And I think we're going to have some awesome posts on parenting in the crazy blue state of California. And she'll bring a perspective from the Bay Area, which needs to be heard to be believed.
Absolutely, absolutely. Another conservative from California. You know, I meet so many of them on the show. I how do you guys lose elections?
You know, it's a long story, and it will unfold for the next 2 years. But hopefully next time, we'll have victory to share with the rest.
Well, you
of
know,
the
we were talking about Barry Goldwater, and there's a great story in one of his books, the memoirs that he wrote. That are just absolutely fantastic. Memoirs that he wrote, and he said one time that after 1964, everywhere he went, people would say, "I voted for you. I voted for you. I voted for you." He said, "I heard that so many times, I got close to asking for a recount because everybody I met said they had voted for me." and you know, that tends to happen. You know, I guess of course he was going out to Republican gatherings, and he's a real idol of the Republican movement. Barry Goldwater. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Barry, thank you so much. And Leslie, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's always a real treat.
You're quite welcome, Silvio, and you all have a good evening.
Leslie, hang with me for a second. Thank you very much, Barry, and we'll catch up with you. I know there's other programs that we'll be doing down the road. But Leslie, I just wanted to take a minute here and talk about the fact that my book is out. And I know I sent you a copy, and hopefully you'll give us your feedback at a later time. I know that you haven't been able to get to it yet, but I just want to thank the audience because I've been getting a lot of nice comments from readers, and I've had some very good reviews of the book. In fact, 4 reviews so far. The first one at Babalu, the second one at a special website that reviews books that have to do with Wisconsin, Captain Capitalism. Our friend Aaron gave me a review, and Richard Baer of the American Thinker wrote a wonderful review on Sunday. And I know there's a couple more coming up, but it's really a treat to have done the book, and I know people are asking me about the book. We're going to be doing a show later this month about the book. We're going to have some of the people who have read the book will be joining me. That way they can ask me some questions. But I have a link to the book on the show information there with Aaron and with Leonard's information. Just click on there. It'll take you to the page on the book. The young man who is with me in the book information is our number 2 son, Gabe, who was very helpful in writing the book, and I decided to give him the opportunity to put his name and picture on there. He was absolutely critical in the writing of the book. So check out the book. It's called Cubanos in Wisconsin. There's a real story to the title, and one of these days when I have time, I'll tell you the story to the title, but it has something to do with my mother, Leslie, and that's why it's called Cubanos in Wisconsin. So I look forward to you reading it and telling me about it one day.
I said, like I said, I've got one thing I need to read up, and then next week, because it's Valentine's week, or it'll be right on the top of the stack. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you so much, Leslie. Good night, and we look forward to chatting with you again, and good night to the audience. Thank you, Barry Jacobson, for joining us. Good night, Leslie, and until the next time.
All right, good night.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for tonight, folks. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Again, I apologize for the little technical glitch that we had there about halfway through the show. I really don't know what happened, but apparently there was a little bit of dead air. Those things happen. But anyway, you didn't lose much of the show, but it did happen. Everybody have a good day, and this is Silvio Canto in Dallas saying goodbye.